Hello and welcome to another episode of California Crime Stories. This podcast is brought to you by a mom and daughter podcasting duo. I'm the daughter.
And I'm the mom.
And here we bring you true tales of murder and mystery from the Golden State. Some are old, some are new, some made national news, and some were small town stories. But all of them have piqued our interest over the years, and we know that they'll pique yours too. Maybe you joined us last episode for our deep dive into the life and death of actor George Reeves, most known for playing Superman on the small screen in the 1950s. Today, we'll be leaving Los Angeles and traveling about 60 miles, almost due east, to the town of Riverside, part of Southern California's Inland Empire. Riverside was a sleepy college town in the 1960s, known for its orange groves and mission-style architecture. That is, until 1966, when peaceful Riverside was rocked by the murder of a young woman on the Riverside City College campus. That young woman was Sherry Jo Bates.
On the morning of Halloween, 1966, a groundskeeper at Riverside City College discovered the body of a young woman sprawled face down on a gravel driveway between two campus buildings. The victim was Sherry Jo Bates, an 18-year-old freshman who had spent the previous evening studying at the campus library. Her killer had stabbed her several times in the back and chest, slit her throat, and then disappeared into the night. The search for Sherry Jo Bates' killer stalled until 1970, when her murder was linked to a series of killings committed in the San Francisco Bay Area by a man who proclaimed himself the Zodiac. For more than 50 years, the elusive Zodiac has been pursued by state and federal law enforcement agencies, journalists, and even amateur sleuths. He has been the subject of best-selling books and Hollywood films. Yet the Zodiac has never been apprehended, and the murders he took credit for remain unsolved. The Zodiac has never been definitively linked to Sherry Jo Bates' murder, but to this day, many remain convinced that she was the Zodiac's first victim. Others believe that Sherry Jo's killer was someone she knew. His identity remains unknown, and Sherry Jo Bates' murder remains unsolved. In researching the murder of Sherry Jo Bates, we drew from West Coast newspaper articles from 1966 through 1971, from Robert Graysmith's book, Zodiac, from a couple of recent long-form pieces in the Riverside Press Enterprise, from a 2017 History Channel miniseries called The Hunt for the Zodiac Killer, a 2018 podcast called Monster, the Zodiac Killer, and from official law enforcement documents and photos related to the Sherry Jo Bates murder and the Zodiac murders.
Sherry Josephine Bates was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1948. In 1959, the family moved to Riverside, where Sherry Jo would attend junior high and high school. Her father, Joseph, was a machinist at a nearby naval laboratory. We don't have much information about Sherry Jo's mother, but we do know that the two parents separated in 1965, and that Sherry Jo's mother moved into a rest home in Riverside. Sherry Jo had a brother named Michael, who was in the Navy in Florida at the time of his sister's death. We have some snippets of information about Sherry Jo's junior and high school years, as remembered by her friends and classmates. In junior high, Sherry Jo performed a song from the musical South Pacific at her school talent show. In high school, she studied hard, earned good grades, participated in student government, and was a cheerleader for the varsity football team. During those years, she also babysat and worked part-time at the Riverside National Bank to save up the money to buy her lime-green Volkswagen Beetle, which she was quite proud of. In her first semester at Riverside City College, Sherry Jo continued to serve as a cheerleader, this time for her college team. After college, she hoped to become an airline stewardess. In her free time, Sherry Jo enjoyed playing the piano and making her own clothes. She also had a boyfriend named Dennis. The two had met in high school. The weekend before her death, Sherry Jo visited Dennis at San Francisco State College, where he was studying and playing football. Sherry Jo and Dennis had been together for 2 years, and were apparently very in love. Sherry Jo's brother, friends, and classmates remember her as a kind, outgoing, and generous young woman who enjoyed making things for others, always had a smile on her face, and had a bright future ahead of her.
In 1966, Sherry Jo had just begun her first semester at RCC and was living with her father Joseph in Riverside. On Sunday morning, October 30th, Sherry Jo and her father went to Mass at St. Catherine's Catholic Church in town and had breakfast together afterwards. Joseph then invited his daughter to spend the day at the beach, but she declined because she had a term paper to work on. So Joseph went to the beach without her. That afternoon, Sherry Jo called her friend Stephanie a couple of times and asked her if she wanted to go to the RCC library that evening to study. Stephanie said no. At some point between 4:30 and 5 p.m., Sherry Jo left for the library. We know this because at 4:30, Sherry Jo's friends drove by her house and saw her Volkswagen Beetle still parked in front. But by 5 p.m., when Sherry Jo's father returned from the beach, she had already gone. She left him a note taped to the refrigerator that said, "Dad, went to the RCC library." After seeing her note, Sherry Jo's father went out again. At some point after leaving her house, Sherry Jo realized that she had misplaced her bibliography for the paper she was working on. So at around 5:30, she called her co-worker Donna at the Riverside National Bank, maybe to ask whether she had left her bibliography at work. The two spoke for a while. It's possible that Sherry Jo called Donna from a phone on campus if she had made it that far without realizing that she didn't have her bibliography with her. Or perhaps she had called from a payphone between her house and the RCC campus.
Regardless, it was around 6 p.m. when Sherry Jo arrived at the campus, since witnesses reported seeing her Beetle around that time on Magnolia Avenue, which runs right in front of the campus. She parked her car on the street. The library would have opened at 6 p.m., and we know that she did enter the library because that evening she checked out 3 textbooks about the Electoral College. According to witnesses, Sherry Jo studied in the library until it closed at around 9 p.m. When she returned to her car, she placed her library books on the front passenger seat and put the key in the ignition. But the Beetle wouldn't start. Sherry Jo then got out of her car, leaving her keys in the ignition and her textbooks behind, but taking her bag with her. We can only theorize what happened next, but we do know that Sherry Jo Bates never returned home. Joseph Bates returned home around midnight, and he found that his daughter hadn't yet returned from the library. But he assumed that she had gone out with friends, so he went to bed, unconcerned. But when Joseph awoke the next morning, Sherry Jo still wasn't home. So Joseph called his daughter's friend Stephanie to see if Sherry Jo was with her. But Stephanie hadn't seen Sherry Jo. At 5:43 a.m. on Monday morning, October 31st, Joseph Bates filed a missing persons report with the Riverside Police.
At around 6:30 a.m., just 45 minutes later, an RCC groundskeeper discovered Sherry Jo Bates' body, sprawled face down on a gravel driveway between 2 unoccupied campus buildings. Sherry Jo was still clad in her yellow blouse and salmon-colored capri pants. She had been stabbed twice in the chest. Her cheek and upper lip were cut, and her throat had been sliced through, almost to the point of decapitation. When she fell to the ground, her killer had stabbed her once more in the shoulder blade and kicked her in the head. Her bag lay on the ground next to her. There was no evidence of sexual assault, but there was visible evidence of a struggle. The gravel around Sherry Jo's body was scuffed and churned up, and a men's Timex wristwatch with a broken watch band was found about 10 feet from the body. The coroner would later find skin and hair under Sherry Jo's fingernails and hair strands in her hand. A men's size 8 to 10 shoe print was found at the scene, which police were later able to trace back to a very specific type of shoe. These shoes were made by prisoners at Leavenworth Prison and could be purchased on military posts. Police found Sherry Jo's car where she had parked it on the street, some 100 feet away from her body. Inside, they found the key in the ignition and the 3 library books on the front seat, just where Sherry Jo had left them. They also found a greasy palm print on the front seat and perhaps other greasy prints on the outside of the car. And when police looked under the hood of the Beetle, they found that its ignition wiring had been pulled loose.
The police quickly developed a narrative based on the evidence gleaned from the crime scene. Sherry Jo's killer had disabled her car while she was studying at the library, waited for her to leave the library when it closed at 9 p.m., and then approached her, offering help or a ride, after she tried and failed to start her car. The killer had then led Bates 100 feet to the gravel driveway where he attacked and killed her. This story more or less jives with the statement of one anonymous caller, who told police that on Sunday night, between 10:15 and 10:45, she heard, quote, an awful scream, followed by another muffled scream, and after a couple minutes of silence, the sound of a car being started up and speeding away. Another ear witness also reported hearing 2 screams at around 10:30 that night. And yet, there's more than an hour between 9 when the library closed and 10:30-ish when the screams were heard that we can't account for. We have 2 possible explanations for this. The first, that Sherry Jo spent a few minutes trying and failing to start her car, and that her killer, ever the Good Samaritan, came up to the car after that and maybe offered to take a look under the hood. Maybe he tinkered with it for a few minutes while the two chatted. Or perhaps Sherry Jo found a payphone and tried to call her father, who at this time wasn't home. If the killer didn't know Sherry Jo, then offering to help her with the car would have helped him to gain her trust and caused her to let her guard down. If the killer did know Sherry Jo, then it would have been even easier to convince her to accept a ride home from him. The other explanation we have for the hour-plus hole in Sherry Jo's timeline stems from the fact that October 30th, 1966, was the end of daylight savings time. That means that as of the morning of October 30th, the day Sherry Jo died, people would have had to set their clocks back 1 hour. What if the 2 ear witnesses actually heard the screams at 9:30 on the night of the 30th, looked at their clocks, which they hadn't changed yet and which still read 10:30? If that were true, then around 30 minutes elapsed between Sherry Jo leaving the library and her screams being heard.
Within 24 hours, police interrogated 75 people and began screening military men from the nearby airbase. This interest was mostly due to the suspected military origin of the shoe print and the Timex wristwatch found at the scene. Police also spoke with fellow RCC students and teachers. At Sherry Jo's funeral, homicide investigators scanned the faces in the crowd of attendees looking for anyone suspicious. 2 weeks after the attack, investigators staged a reenactment of the night of Sherry Jo's murder. The 65 people who had been in the RCC library on the night of October 30th were asked to wear the same clothes, park in the same places, sit in the same seats, and recreate all of their movements. The Riverside police captain and his car stood in for Sherry Jo and her Beetle. Investigators conducted tape-recorded interviews with all those present, asking what time they arrived on the night of October 30th, where they parked, what other vehicles they noticed, who they saw, and if they recalled seeing anyone that night who wasn't present at the reenactment. Fingerprints and hair samples were taken from each man present. Only 2 people who had been seen in the library the night of October 30th were not present later at the reenactment. 1 woman and 1 man, young and heavy set, about 5'11", with a beard. neither of these individuals were ever found or identified, nor was a late 40s, early 1950s model tan gray Studebaker with oxidized paint that was also seen in the area on the night of Sherry Jo Bates' murder. A month after the murder, the Riverside Police and Riverside's local newspaper, the Daily Enterprise, received a chilling and detailed letter from someone purporting to be Bates' killer. In this typed letter, titled The Confession, the author recounts how he disabled Bates' car, waited for her in the library, offered her a ride when her car wouldn't start, and lured her to the spot where he attacked and killed her. The author also claimed that he had made Bates, quote, pay for the brush-offs she had given me in years prior. He also confirms that he was the person who made a call to Riverside Police claiming responsibility for Sherry Jo Bates' murder. Although the author of the letter mentions making this call, we cannot confirm from law enforcement or any other source we have come across if and when this call was made.
Police were convinced that this typed confession was written by Sherry Jo Bates' killer, because they claimed that it included details that only the killer would know. The author does specifically mention pulling out the middle wire from the Volkswagen Beetle's distributor. But as far as we could tell from our reading, the fact that the car's distributor was disabled was reported by the media in the days after the murder. So we're not sure how incriminating that detail about the distributor wire really was. Police also believe that the author of this letter was familiar with identification techniques used by law enforcement. He had set his typewriter to all caps, and then fed a stack of paper into the typewriter, alternating sheets of regular typewriter paper and carbon paper. When he typed the confession, the words were transferred from the first sheet of typewriter paper to the carbon sheet below it, to the next sheet of paper, and so on. The author then chose two copies from the bottom of the stack to send to the Daily Enterprise and to the police, so that there would be no fingerprints on the paper, and the type would be too blurred for investigators to easily identify the make of the typewriter used to type the letter. 5 months after the murder, a custodian at the RCC library came across a desktop in a storage area. Someone had etched a short yet gruesome poem into the surface of the desk with a blue ballpoint pen. And I'm going to read the poem now. It's a little bit graphic, just to give you a heads up. Sick of living. Unwilling to die. Cut. Clean. If red, clean. Blood spurting, dripping, spilling all over her new dress. Oh well, it was red anyway. Life draining into an uncertain death. She won't die, this time. Someone will find her. Just wait till next time. At the bottom, the poem was seemingly signed with two lowercase letters, R.H.
6 months after the murder, the supposed killer sent another note, this time to the Riverside Police, the Daily Enterprise, and to Sherry's father, Joseph Bates. This one was handwritten and simply read, quote, Bates had to die. There will be more. So there were a couple of minute differences between the letters. The letters received by the police and by the newspaper were signed with a single symbol, resembling a letter Z or a number 2. The letter to Joseph Bates was unsigned and referred to Sherry Jo as she instead of as Bates. During the Riverside Police's initial investigation, they considered several suspects. In 1966, police were able to identify the skin under Sherry Jo's fingernails and hair strands in her hand as originating from a white male. Sherry Jo's boyfriend Dennis was quickly ruled out, as he was studying in San Francisco at the time of her murder and had a solid alibi. Police investigated a young man who worked in the RCC library at the time of Sherry Jo's murder and exhibited some strange behavior in the aftermath. There was another promising person of interest, a local young man who knew Sherry Joe. The chief investigator on the case at that time believed that this young man was Sherry Joe's killer. They were able to build a case against him based on circumstantial evidence, but they knew it likely wouldn't hold up in court. You'll hear more about these two men later on in the episode. For several years, investigators were unable to make any further progress on the Sherry Joe Bates case. But in 1970, an anonymous tip received by a reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle would bring new attention to the case and forever change the lens through which police, journalists, and amateur sleuths view the murder of Sherry Joe Bates.
Paul Avery was the San Francisco Chronicle's top investigative reporter in 1970. And since August 1969, when local newspapers like the Chronicle began receiving letters from a serial killer identifying himself as the Zodiac, the Bay Area's Zodiac murders had been Avery's beat. Avery became such a prominent figure in media coverage of the Zodiac murders that the killer wrote to Avery personally, making threats against his life. In the fall of 1970, Avery received an anonymous letter from Southern California, asking him to look into the unsolved murder of a young girl in Riverside in 1966, which showed some similarities to the Zodiac murders. That young girl was, of course, Sherry Joe Bates. The same anonymous tipster who had contacted Avery had for several years been writing to the Riverside police and asking them to consider a possible connection between the Bates murder and the subsequent Zodiac killings. So the Zodiac was already on the Riverside police's radar by 1970, and they had actually been in contact with Bay Area police. But it was Paul Avery's interest and involvement that brought the so-called Riverside connection to the attention of the public. Shortly after receiving the anonymous letter, Paul Avery contacted the Riverside police captain, who sent him the investigators' reports on the Bates murder. Those reports included a photograph of the handwritten letters received by police 6 months after the murder, signed with what appeared to be a single letter Z.
Avery immediately made the drive from San Francisco to Riverside, where he met with the police captain and the chief investigator assigned to Sherry Joe's case. The officers briefed Avery on the details of the case, showed him a copy of the typed confession letter, and left him to go through the rest of the Bates file, which by then was rather large. In it, Avery found the other two copies of the handwritten note sent to the Riverside Daily Enterprise and to Sherry Joe's father, and a photo of the desktop found in storage at RCC. Avery pointed out to investigators the similarities between the handwritten Riverside notes in their envelopes, the desktop poem, and the handwritten Zodiac letters received by the Chronicle. At this point, Avery convinced the Riverside police to reopen the Bates investigation in association with Bay Area law enforcement's Zodiac investigation. To preserve the chain of custody, Paul Avery himself carried the original letters and envelopes from Sherry Joe's killer, along with a photo of the desktop, on board a plane to Sacramento. There he gave the evidence to Sherwood Morrill, a handwriting expert and head of the Questioned Documents Department at California's Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation. After several days of analysis, Sherwood Morrill declared that the handwriting in the Riverside letters was, quote, unquestionably the work of the Zodiac. He also stated that, quote, the handprinting scratched on the desk is the same as on the three letters, particularly like that on the envelopes, and this handprinting is by the same person who has been preparing the Zodiac letters that have been received by the Chronicle. Paul Avery shared his own findings, which he called the Riverside Connection, and the results of Sherwood Morrill's handwriting analysis in a November 1970 Chronicle article titled, Zodiac Link is Definite.
Still, the Riverside police weren't so sure. In response to Sherwood Morrill's findings, the police captain said that any connection between Sherry Joe Bates' murder and the Zodiac killings, quote, doesn't look too good, really. The police wondered whether the Zodiac had simply written the letters and taken credit for the Bates murder to gain publicity. What's more, they liked someone else for the murder, that local man who knew Sherry Joe, but against whom the police only had circumstantial evidence. But the next year, Riverside police would be a bit swayed by a Zodiac letter received by the Los Angeles Times in March of 1971. In it, the Zodiac appeared to claim responsibility for the murder of Sherry Joe Bates. He doesn't refer to her by name, but he does say, quote, I do have to give them, referring to the police, credit for stumbling across my Riverside activity. He goes on to say, quote, they are only finding the easy ones. There are a hell of a lot more down there. That 1971 letter led the Riverside police captain to reconsider whether Sherry Joe Bates was a victim of the Zodiac. It's interesting to note, though, that the Zodiac was quiet for around 4 months between when Paul Avery broke the story of the Riverside connection and when the 1971 Riverside activity letter was received by the LA Times. The Zodiac was always quick to claim responsibility for his murders, and even for murders he likely didn't commit, in his letters to the press. Did police's discovery of the Riverside connection leave him feeling scared or vulnerable? Did he fear that he had left evidence behind which could incriminate him?
So we're now going to fast forward over 50 years to the present, 2021. Where is the Sherry Joe Bates case today? Over the years, the Riverside police have abandoned again the theory that Sherry Joe Bates was murdered by the Zodiac. They believe that the killer was someone who Sherry Joe had brushed off or someone who knew her in some other capacity. In recent years, police developed a DNA profile from Sherry Joe's fingernail scrapings and the hairs found in her hand. That DNA profile did not match the suspect Riverside police have always liked for the murder, and has not been matched to anyone that law enforcement currently have on file. In 2017, the pants Sherry Joe Bates was wearing on the night of her murder were even processed using the groundbreaking MVAC system, which is a sort of wet vacuum that can collect DNA from porous or degraded pieces of evidence. The results of this collection method proved equally inconclusive. Going forward, it appears that the solution to Sherry Joe's case lies in forensic genealogy and sites like GEDmatch, which could give investigators access to DNA profiles of people who aren't currently in their system. If one day a relative of the killer uploads their DNA to one of these genealogy sites, law enforcement would be able to find the killer using that familial connection.
To this day, there are only 3 men that we know of who Riverside police have considered as potential suspects in the Sherry Joe Bates case. We're now going to tell you a little bit more about each suspect and break down the evidence that implicates each one in the murder of Sherry Joe Bates. First, we have the local young man who knew Sherry Joe. You'll remember that this was the suspect that investigators liked for her murder, even as Paul Avery broke the story of the so-called Riverside connection between the Bates murder and the Zodiac killings in Northern California. Police were able to build a case against this suspect based on circumstantial evidence, but they knew it wouldn't hold up in court, so he was never charged. Law enforcement have never identified this man by name. We have seen a name floating around on Zodiac message boards and websites, but since this man is still alive and still a person of interest, we don't feel comfortable sharing that name with you. And we don't have much in the way of inculpatory or exculpatory evidence for the suspect, since he's still a subject of ongoing investigation. Riverside police have kept their cards very close to their chest as regards the suspect and the entire case, really. But we do know that the DNA collected from Sherry Joe's fingernail scrapings and from hair samples found at the crime scene does not match this guy.
So next we have the young man who worked in the RCC library at the time of Sherry Joe's murder and exhibited some strange behavior in the aftermath. We can identify this man. His name was Ross Sullivan, and he was 25 years old at the time of the murder. There is plenty of incriminating circumstantial evidence against Ross Sullivan. He attended RCC, so he would have been familiar with the campus. He worked at the library where Sherry Jo Bates was last seen alive, and he also would have known that the two campus buildings on either side of the alley where Sherry Jo was found were vacant because they were used as storage for overflow library books. He may not have known Sherry Jo personally, but perhaps he had seen her around campus or in the library. RCC was not a big school, and Sherry Jo's car definitely stood out on campus. Shortly after the murder, several RCC library employees reached out to the Riverside Police on their own initiative and outlined their concerns and suspicions about their co-worker Ross Sullivan. Ross was known to behave strangely, to write creepy poems, and to wear the exact same ensemble of military-style clothing and boots every day. You'll remember that the footprint found at the crime scene was traced back to a shoe that could be purchased on military posts. A lot would be made of this military connection. But it's also true that in those days, military clothing and footwear could be purchased at surplus shops throughout the United States. So maybe we shouldn't make so much of Ross Sullivan's military fashions. But regardless, Ross's co-workers also reported that he didn't come to work for several weeks following the Bates murder, and that when he did return, he was wearing a completely new outfit. Now, the only problem with Ross Sullivan as a suspect is that law enforcement don't have his DNA on file. He died in 1977 and was cremated, and his surviving brother has reportedly refused to give a DNA sample to rule his brother out.
And finally, of course, we have the Zodiac. Although the link between Sherry Jo Bates's murder and the Zodiac killings may not be as definitive as Paul Avery claimed it was in 1970, there is still plenty of circumstantial evidence that points to the Zodiac as both the killer of Sherry Jo and the author of the subsequent typed and handwritten letters received by the Riverside Police and press. Sherry Jo Bates's murder was, in many ways, in keeping with the Zodiac's modus operandi. The Zodiac murdered his victims with either a knife or a gun. He never raped or sexually assaulted any of his victims. And on one occasion, he disabled a young woman's car, and in the guise of giving her a ride to a service station, he drove her around for hours, threatening to kill her and her baby. Now let's compare the typed and handwritten notes received by the Riverside Police and press to the letters we know were sent by the Zodiac. First, the typewritten confession sent 1 month after Sherry Jo Bates' murder. Investigators at the time were convinced that the confession was written by Sherry Jo's killer. So let's assume that to be true. Well, there are a lot of similarities between the typed confession and the confirmed Zodiac letters received by police and newspapers in the Bay Area. The author of the typed confession asks for the letter to be published in newspapers, quote, for all to read it. Meanwhile, the Zodiac always insisted that his letters be published too. The confession includes two slightly unusual words, squirm and twitch, spelled T-W-I-C-H. One of the Zodiac letters also uses those same two words, with twitch misspelled the same way. The author of the confession refers to, quote, the game in his letter. Meanwhile, the Zodiac referenced the most dangerous game in one of his letters. As for the handwritten notes sent 6 months after the murder, two of the copies were signed with a letter Z, and a handwriting expert identified them as being written by the Zodiac. And there's the desktop found in RCC storage with the creepy poem, also identified by the same handwriting expert as being the work of the Zodiac.
And we're treating Ross Sullivan and the Zodiac as two different suspects here, but it's entirely possible that they're one and the same person. Ross Sullivan isn't only on the short list of potential suspects in the Sherry Jo Bates murder. He's also on the short list of suspects in the Zodiac killings. However, It is also very possible that the Zodiac, whoever he was, wrote the notes, both the typed confession and the handwritten notes, but didn't kill Sherry Jo. It wouldn't be the only time that the Zodiac took credit for a murder that he did not commit. The Zodiac took advantage of every opportunity to boast about his supposed crimes, taunt investigators, and draw attention to himself.
Now, if you have ever done any research about the Zodiac case, you know as well as we do that going down the Zodiac rabbit hole is always going to be an infinite time suck. And part of what is so frustrating about the Zodiac case and the investigation is that people seem to always be hitching their wagon to certain details, whether it's the Zodiac's use of military boots, his knowledge of code, his references to popular films, or how much he weighs, or how tall he is. And then once they hitch their wagon to that detail, they start making these enormous illogical leaps to make all of the other pieces fit. And trying to identify the Zodiac, for me, is like building a house of cards. You have your suspect, and you start assembling the house, stacking the cards you have against your suspect. And the cards are what you think you know to be true. It gets higher and higher, you're closer and closer to being able to definitively identify the Zodiac, and then someone comes along, takes out one of your cards, and the whole thing collapses. And when you're investigating the Zodiac, it's like you can never close the loop, because you can connect the Zodiac to Sherry Jo and to Riverside, and then you can find a really convincing Zodiac suspect, but then you can't place that suspect back in Riverside with Sherry Jo. So the pieces just never quite fit. But for me, Ross Sullivan is the most compelling suspect for the murder of Sherry Jo Bates. And that's because he knew the library and the campus. He knew that those two campus buildings would be vacant. He wrote creepy poems. He made his female co-workers feel uneasy and behave strangely. He wore military clothes. And he disappeared after the murder, only to turn up weeks later with a new outfit. Some sources report that Sherry Jo and Ross Sullivan knew each other, because Ross's brother was dating one of Sherry Jo's friends. We don't feel comfortable enough about that information to confirm it, because we only saw it in a few places, but I feel almost certain that the two would have at least seen each other around campus. Because like we said, RCC wasn't a big school, and it seems like Sherry Jo was popular and had a big network of friends. Now, all of this is very compelling, but very circumstantial evidence against Ross. But I did come across one other interesting anecdote about him that is, again, totally circumstantial. In the late 1950s, when he was a student at Glendale High School, Ross Sullivan acted in a film called Deja Vive, directed by some fellow Glendale students. This film has not survived, as far as we know, but we do have a newspaper article about the film and the testimony of a gentleman named Chuck Buck, who acted in and produced the film. And Buck recalls that during the course of making that film, he and Ross Sullivan were to film a murder scene together. Buck was playing the assailant, and Sullivan was playing the victim. They rehearsed the scene many times. Buck confronted Sullivan with a knife in a dark alley on Skid Row, and after a struggle, Buck stabbed Sullivan with a knife. Sullivan screamed, clutched his wound, and fell face down, dead. And this film would later get written up in the papers, because just as Buck and Sullivan were to film that murder scene on Skid Row for the movie, the police showed up because they thought that the altercation was real. So the scene was never filmed, and the film was never finished. And Chuck Buck lost touch with Ross Sullivan over the years, but more recently he was contacted by someone who asked about his connection to Ross Sullivan, who by then was a suspect in the Zodiac killings. What does the story tell us about Ross Sullivan? That he was interested in films and filmmaking, that he had thought about and acted out an alleyway attack similar to the one that would happen to Sherry Jo Bates? Well, that's about all it tells us. Acting in a creepy indie film is not a crime and does not a killer make. However, I do think that one day, either Ross Sullivan's surviving brother or one of his relatives or descendants will agree to provide law enforcement with a DNA sample, and he will come up as the match for the DNA found under Sherry Jo Bates's fingernails. I think Ross Sullivan's our guy for this case. But I'm not so sure that Ross Sullivan is my favorite suspect for the Zodiac murders. I go back and forth between Ross Sullivan and another suspect. And I also go back and forth about the letters received after Sherry Jo Bates's murder and the desktop poem. The sample size of handwriting of those written notes is so small. Handwriting analysis is not an exact science. And there were some misidentifications of writing samples as being written by the Zodiac during that initial investigation. And I don't think that the typed confession necessarily had to have been written by the killer. I find it hard to believe that if the Zodiac didn't kill Sherry Jo Bates, he would come all the way down to Riverside, go to the library, and etch the poem into a desk. The poem also isn't about Sherry Jo Bates. It could have been written by some other creepy or disturbed individual who was in no way connected to Sherry Jo's murder, and I'm inclined to believe that. So, in short, I think Ross Sullivan killed Sherry Jo Bates. I'm not convinced that the Riverside letters were written by the Zodiac or that they were actually written by the killer. And I'm even less sure that Ross Sullivan was the Zodiac.
Okay, so first off, I'm going to reiterate that looking at this case with the depth of research that it merits required a Zodiac deep dive that I think both of us are totally over now.
We're over you, Mr. Z. I'm done with you.
Just the attempt to verify facts of the case and pinpoint timelines, which should not really be in dispute, involved off-ramps to subjects that ended up just frustratingly far from our desired focus on Sherry Jo. I like your House of Cards analogy, and I like another one that you mentioned, which is that of a too small blanket that you're trying to stretch in different ways in order to, like, fully cover yourself and get warm. I'm unable to stretch the blanket far enough to convince myself that Ross Sullivan could be the Zodiac. Too many times, as we've hashed out our research together, it sounds like we're trying to make quote-unquote evidence or quote-unquote facts fit a preconceived narrative or suspect. And that is something that we know results in wrongful convictions. So I do agree that Sherry Jo was likely killed by an acquaintance or a classmate, both because of the way that Sherry was sort of lured into accompanying this person away from her car, and also because of the viciousness of the attack, which to me looks like overkill and may indicate a personal connection between her and her killer. And I also think that the fact that Ross Sullivan's co-workers at the RCC library took it upon themselves to contact law enforcement with their suspicions about him, like, to me, that is very telling. The History Channel miniseries that touched on this case sort of within the context of Zodiac showed one of Ross's co-workers commenting about their collective suspicions at the time, and that she's like, she still looks really creeped out by him, like, to this day.
Yeah. Well, we'd like to close our discussion by talking about Sherry Jo Bates's legacy. Her murder left an indelible mark on the city of Riverside and on Riverside City College. Crimes like that just didn't happen in Riverside, and Sherry Jo Bates's murder sort of stripped the city of its innocence. It devastated the RCC community as well. Those who were on campus in 1966 say that students and faculty were on high alert for a long time after the murder. And those Riversiders who lived through Sherry Jo's murder and are still alive today haven't forgotten it. But Sherry Jo's legacy doesn't end there. 54 years after her murder, a scholarship at Riverside City College still bears her name. The Sherry Jo Bates Memorial Endowed Scholarship is awarded every year to an RCC student majoring in music who has a minimum 3.0 GPA, is active in school and athletic activities, and demonstrates financial need. It's not a large scholarship. It's only about $400 these days. But hopefully the student who receives it thinks about Sherry Jo and wonders who she might have been. The investigation into the murder of Sherry Jo Bates remains active. If you have information that could lead to the identification of Sherry Jo's killer, we urge you to call the Riverside Police Department using one of the phone numbers we've provided in the show notes.
Now that we've finished our dive into the murder of Sherry Jo Bates, we'd like to close with a segment we're calling CCS Recommends, where we'll each be sharing with you a movie, book, podcast, recipe, artist, or some other cool thing that we're enjoying at the moment.
So my recommendation for this week is a cocktail book called Booze and Vinyl, a spirited guide to great music and mixed drinks. This book pairs cocktails with popular albums of all genres, from rock to rap, from Blondie to Bon Iver. And for each album, you'll get a little information about the album to get you in the mood to listen to it. You get two cocktail recipes, and you might even get a snack that pairs well with the theme. So we're a family of music enthusiasts and drinkers, a little more so during these stressful times, and a little more so after getting through the Zodiac, Jesus. And every night for the last few months, we've tried a fun new cocktail and listened to an album that we may never have heard before. It's brought a couple of artists to our attention, namely Bjork and A Tribe Called Quest, for sure, that we will definitely be returning to in the future. So if you like listening to music and drinking adult water, maybe even both at the same time, or if this episode stressed you out a little bit and need a drink to relax, check out the book Booze and Vinyl.
Okay, so I watch a fair amount of news and such, sometimes with a boozy cocktail in my hand. I'm kind of a politics geek, and I've really enjoyed watching the Skype or Zoom pack backgrounds of commentators and scholars and historians and prognosticators, whatever, in their homes. So I'm sure for some of you this is not a new recommendation, but I really like the Room Raider Twitter feed at Rate My Skype Room. They are Canadians, I think, and they just make observations of folks' wall color, their bookshelves and tchotchkes, houseplants, the camera angle and lighting. They even comment on the occasional canine, feline, or little human who's like crashing the broadcast. They often offer suggestions and encouragements as to how the room or the camera setup can be improved. And what really cracks me up is when the room ratee then tweets back either their appreciation for a high score, they're so proud of themselves, or sometimes this super lame explanation for why their score is low. But even if they come up with this super lame explanation, they invariably like try to clean up their act for the next TV appearance. So anyways, it's fun. Check it out.
It's really lighthearted, I think, because at the end of the day, like, we're all working from home and the circumstances are more often than not ideal, and everyone's just doing their best to show up for Zoom and do their job. So it's fun and funny, and yeah, it's a good time. So check out Room Raider. So thanks for tuning in to another episode of California Crime Stories. If you have any questions or feedback for us, or if you want to suggest a case that you think we should cover in a future episode, you can send us an email at feedback@ccspod.com. That's feedback@ccspod.com. Our podcast is now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, on our website, ccspod.com, and on lots of other platforms. And you can follow us on Twitter now, @theCCSPod. Where we'll be posting some photos to go along with the episode and letting you know about upcoming episodes. California Crime Stories is researched, written, and produced by us, your hosts, with artwork also provided by us. Our theme is Arcadia by Cody Martin. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.